I don't know if you have had those situations where maybe you're standing at the traffic lights, or perhaps you were learning to drive and you're stalling at the traffic lights, and then someone pulls up alongside you and yells out some sort of gag at you. Say you're trying to drive your learner's car and the person pulls up alongside you and yells out, "Stall! Stall!" And you know, you're feeling awful already, and now you've got this person sort of yelling at you, and your mind just goes blank. You want to say something really cutting back, but suddenly your mind just goes empty. And all you can think of is, or something. That's about the best that can come out. You know those situations? You're being picked on at school and someone, you know, has this kind of line, "Oh, you know, you're an idiot," or something really dumb, and you know it's dumb, and then you go, "Sorry." That's the best that can come up. You know, in the spur of the moment, your mind goes blank, you say something pretty lame. Of course, 5 minutes later, you think of something awesome, but then it's too late. Perhaps it's you're walking through town and someone from the Mercury comes up to you and, you know, vox pops you about some hot question. You know, "What do you think about this?" And again, your mind just goes blank. And you go, "I think it's good, maybe." And you really hope they don't publish some moronic thing that you've said in the spur of the moment. Or you're doing like a discussion, an icebreaker maybe, in some kind of group, a youth group or a shoot or something. And you all have to, "What do you want to do with your life?" Again, your mind goes blank. I don't know. Have fun. Be happy. And you just sort of say these things, kind of half answers. Now, that's fine. Not all of us are good at thinking on our feet. Not all of us are great at giving those quick answers, right? Sometimes we do stumble when we're put on the spot and we need to take time to go away and think of the awesome thing that we would have said if only the person had given us the questions beforehand. But the sad thing is, sometimes with life, we never go further than that. That sometimes with life, when really we dwell on it, actually I haven't gone any further than basically, what do I want to do with my life? I don't know, have fun, I guess. Something about travel, be happy, ish. And that's about as far as I've gotten. And so I work according to that roadmap of sort of that way. and even in areas of our lives more narrowly, such as in the topic of this series of making love, the area of relationships and of love and of sexuality, we don't really go much further than that initial, almost kind of the first thing that pops into my head. Oh, well, I guess relationships and making love is whatever makes you feel good. Sounds kind of cool. I think I heard that off a Coke ad. That sounds good. I guess it's kind of if it makes you happy. I don't know. Hugh Grant said something that was kind of cute. That's probably right. And so we live our lives sometimes, in general or in particular areas, based on very little careful thought, very little detailed kind of reflection. And if there's anything you can know about life, life is complicated, life is hard, life is difficult, life has lots of ins and outs to it. And a simple mind going blank, "I guess just try and be happy, if it feels good, I guess it's okay, as long as you have the freedom to do what you want to do," that's just not going to cut it in life. With the pains, the difficulties, the complexities, the challenges, the crises of decision you have to make. Those quick, almost not thinking answers are just not enough. And we really suffer if that's as far as we go. Is the answer of Christianity, "Here's the rules then"? Okay, you don't have a general idea. Okay, I've got 80,000 rules of things you can't do. That way, you'll know how to live your life. Just don't do all of these things and you'll be fine. No. Christianity is not just about a bunch of rules or rituals and don't do this and don't do this. Not in general, nor in the particular area of making love. Christianity is not just that. In fact, as one Christian ethics writer in Australia called Andrew Cameron has said, Christianity in the first place is about saying a big yes to the world. In salvation, God has said yes to the world. He sent his son to save the world, not judge it. God has said yes to our world. In mercy and in love and forgiveness, he said yes. But as this ethics writer goes on to say, sometimes after that initial yes of salvation, we slip into a lot of no's. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other, bad, 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 naughty, all right, but probably shouldn't do it just to be safe, bad. And we slip into a big yes, God has said yes in salvation, and then a lot of fine print like a mobile phone contract, lots and lots of no's, yeah? But what this ethics writer says to us is that we must recognise that actually the whole of the Christian life, is about God's ongoing yes. He doesn't just say yes in salvation, but he says, yes, here is how to live at peace with God. He says, yes, here is how to live at peace with others. Yes, here is how to live at peace in God's world. And in fact, God has in plan and preparation a hope for the future, a new heavens and a new earth, the kingdom of God. God is looking ahead and says this world won't end just in kind of massive polar ice cap melting and then energy death, but actually God will make a new heavens, a new earth. Just as Christ rose from the dead, all of us will rise from the dead. God is about in the business of saying yes. And so we as Christians, in the way we live and in our morals and in our relationships and in our making love even, should be all about seeing how that yes that God says to the world he has made can be shown in the way we live. And so beginning with that really positive outlook, which I think is surprising to some people, my first point today on this topic of pleasure and beauty, my first point today is that part of worship is pleasure and beauty. Part of worship is pleasure and beauty. That Christian religion is not merely morals and discipline and denial and rules and guilt and sorrow and sackcloth and... But Christian religion is pleasure, delight, joy, satisfaction. And these are words you'll find right through your Christian Bible if you do a word search on it. It's not simply, here is what is right and good and holy and shut up and do it. But rather, rejoice, delight, taste. You think it's a bit strange to say? I think definitely if you asked a lot of others, even here on campus, a lot of others, even tertiary educated, a lot of others even educating the tertiary educated, they would say, no, that's not Christianity. Let me give you some examples. First of all, just from some general writers and thinkers of Christianity. In the 16th century, one of the most influential kind of creeds of the Protestant Reformation was the Westminster Confession of Faith. And in the kind of the question and answer teaching that goes along with that confession, called their catechism, they begin by asking, what's the meaning of life? What's the purpose of human life? And the answer is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. What's the purpose of human life according to one of the most influential Christian documents of the 16th century? To glorify God and enjoy him. Enjoy him. Today, one of a very influential pastor and writer and theologian is a man named John Piper. You know, he's not one of these fringe wackos that we like to point to when we talk about Christianity. Oh, Christians believe this. I dug this guy up out of somewhere in America and he is completely nuts. You Christians are nuts. Now, we're not talking about just the kind of the most nutty person you can find to impose Christianity on. This is someone who is a mainline, recognized, widely influential Christian pastor, right? So Christians around the world would recognize him as being someone who was an influence and valuable. This man, John Piper, who's worth reading, if you can find anything written by him or sermons by him, he's worth listening to. He describes himself as a Christian hedonist. He says Christianity is as a form of hedonism, pleasure seeking, a Christian pleasure seeker. I mean, he's deliberately being provocative to try and make the point that part of worship for Christians is pleasure, a Christian pleasure seeker. And here's his famous quote. John Piper says, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. And you can find these very ideas in the Bible itself. Constant commands, delight in the Lord. And then God saying that your sacrifices and your prayers are a pleasing aroma to me. In Genesis chapter 2 that we looked at the Citywide last week, in Genesis chapter 2, God has made everything and he says it's very good. And then he makes the man and makes the woman and puts them in this garden, luscious garden, all this fruit they can eat, all these trees, gold dribbling out of the rivers, and gives them to one another. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, standing naked and feeling no shame. In Psalm 104, it might be worth coming and having a look at that one. It's a huge celebration of the world that God has made, Psalm 104. And it celebrates, again, the riches, the pleasure, the delight, the glory of the world that God has made.
We'll read from verse 10, Psalm 104, verse 10. God makes the springs pour water into the ravines. It flows between the mountains. They give water to all the beasts of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. The birds of the air nest by the waters. They sing among the branches. He waters the mountains from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied by the fruit of his work. He makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for man to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth, wine that gladdens the heart of man, and oil that makes his face shine, and bread that sustains his heart. The trees of the Lord are well watered, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted, the birds make their nest, the storks have its home in the pine trees, the high mountains belong to the wild goats, the crags are a refuge for the conies. The world that God has made is fantastic, so that in verse 24 he says, "How many are your works, O Lord? In the wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of all your creatures. There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number," and on and on and on. It's fantastic. It's a world to enjoy. There's food to enjoy. There's bread to enjoy. There's oil to enjoy. There's wine to enjoy. Deuteronomy 14 has a command that all these givings that come out of the religion of ancient Israel should be all hoarded together, and a huge feast should be had where all the people, all the priests, all the poor, all those without families come together and have a huge feast enjoying God's good gifts. Proverbs chapter 5, and much of Proverbs, in fact, talks about enjoying many of the good gifts, including making love. Find satisfaction in the wife of your youth, and may her breasts satisfy you always, says Proverbs. And then 1 Timothy 4 that was read for us. 1 Timothy 4 tells us that all the things that God has created are good. They're sanctified, they're consecrated by the word of God and prayer, and that it's a demonic thing to deny marriage, a demonic thing to deny food and drink. Everything, 1 Timothy 4 verse 4, everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. Pleasure is not only natural. Pleasure is a supernatural, spiritual thing, a part of God's creation, part of God's gift. It wasn't an accident. And so that calls on us, as 1 Timothy 4 does, to give thanks. Verse 4, everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. We should look at the world, the mountains, the rivers, the seas, the creatures, the through the microscope, the intricacies of how everything hangs together, the things that get so ridiculous in the way the sort of the subatomic stuff works that it's silly, and scientists start giving it silly names. It's so silly. We should rejoice then at the huge things that are so mind-bogglingly big. Again, it's just silly that we have to come up with silly words for the numbers of how big everything is. We should be giving thanks to God for the big and the small, the fast and the slow, the amazing, the frightening, and the beautiful and the fragile, right? All of that is God, and we should give thanks to him for it. For the sport that we enjoy, you know, give thanks for that. For the computer games we play, or the beautiful guys and girls who walk past us, for the greasy breakfast that we clog our veins with, for the awesome shoes that we spent far too much money on. All of which are God's good gifts. Gifts that it would be wrong to not thank him for. That the problem is not enjoying the stuff. The problem is not seeing it and valuing it. The problem is we begin by not recognizing the one who gave it. That's where the problems begin. And that's when everything starts to get all out of whack. It's a bit like a spider's web. If you just pull out one strand from a spider's web, as, you know, maybe a kind of a, you know, kind of a mean, sadistic little five-year-old might be inclined to do, and you kind of pull out a strand, the whole thing goes, doesn't it? It gets all sort of skew-iff. In the same way, if we stop giving thanks to God for the world he's made, that's where the coveting, and that's where the greed, and that's where the abuse begins to come in. Don't be ungrateful, says the Bible, but give thanks. Don't reject the good things that God has given, denying the things he's created, but recognize their goodness and give him thanks as part of your worship. It's a call, you see, to enjoy God's world. Just as one of the most satisfying parts of eating the food that someone's cooked for you is enjoying it and then praising them and saying, "Thank you, I ate it, I liked it, it was great, and you're awesome for cooking it for me. Please cook it again." Or if someone gives you a CD, you go, "Thank you for the CD, I'll put the CD on. I'll listen to it, I'll enjoy it." It's a little bit awkward, isn't it, when someone gives you kind of like the, you know, the Hutchins School Choir CD for Christmas, and you go, "Thanks, yeah, I'll listen to that." And then they ask you, "Have you listened to it? and you've kind of thrown it away sort of accidentally, kind of on purpose. I've sort of listened to it, just doesn't quite work. Part of the gift is to receive and enjoy and give thanks, isn't it? God's world is not the good china. God's world is not the trophy car. God's world is a world to be used, enjoyed, delighted in. He's to be thanked for it. It's not glorifying God to live a life that is dull and grey and unimaginative. It's glorifying to God to enjoy his world, cultivate his world, love others in it. It should be, if you're someone who sees this world as God's world, right? And the people in it as people God has made, then it should be a great delight to discover more about God, a great delight to discover more of God's people. There is something, even the shy Christian is a people person in a way, because they believe other people are made by God and want to love and serve them. Yeah? Even the cautious, nervous Christian is in a sense an adventurer because they want to discover more of God's world. Yeah? We've got to be careful about being people who just, I just mind my own business and do my own thing and keep to my own habits. I mean, you know, we have, each have different temperaments. But beware of actually closing yourself off to the world God has put you in. Beware of closing yourself off to the world God has put you in. Or the person who's so picky about their taste. It's got to be coffee. It's got to be Arabica coffee. It's got to be Arabica coffee from Colombia. And it's got to be dry processed and wet roasted and have a hint of lemon. Otherwise, I just can't possibly... Beware of so narrowing in your tastes. You know, oh, I don't watch that sport. You know, I don't eat that food. That you actually close yourself up from the people and the world that God has made. And so, in making love, pleasure and beauty are things to be enjoyed. In their right place, in the right way, all the things that we'll explore, how to do that in a way that's right and good and honor, loving to others and honoring to God. But Christianity ought not be so obsessed with confession and with guilt and with the listing and obsessing over what is wrong and each desire and cataloguing that out to find more stuff to feel awful about and heaping on more rules to be more careful about possibly accidentally maybe sinning in some sort of way, that we miss the fact that that God made this world, including the sexuality of this world, as something good to be enjoyed. The danger of taboo is it actually adds a different kind of pleasure, a secretive, lustful pleasure. When you create taboo around, say, sexuality, or anything naughty, then you think you're protecting yourself from it. Oh, that's dangerous, I could sin. But by creating a taboo there, suddenly it's interesting in a different way. Yeah? Suddenly it becomes intriguing because I can't do it, and intriguing because I can't see it. Beware of a morality of taboo. Yeah? Thanksgiving and recognizing the goodness of God's world is a very powerful part of living a healthy moral life, is seeing that which is good and delighting in it where it is, rather than, oh no, mustn't look, mustn't touch, now I just want it more. Yeah? Secondly, and building on this, pleasure is a part of worship, but the world that we live in, the world God has made, is a world of other people, not just a world of you and a bunch of things to enjoy. Okay, so it's not just do what feels good, whatever you find that satisfies you, just choose what you want to choose, be who you want to be, find whatever suits you. That's not the world we live in. We live in a world of other people, lots of other people. God has put you in a world of other people, and the second greatest commandment he gives to us, in addition to loving him and giving him thanks, is loving our neighbour. The golden rule, love your neighbour as yourself. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Love your neighbour. And this brings us to the Romans passage. So leaving 1 Timothy aside, moving back to Romans 15. Romans chapter 15 is just a great passage in reinforcing this so clearly, I think. Romans 15, verse 1. We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Each of us should please his neighbour for his good, to build him up. For even Christ did not please himself. We are not on our own, and our lives and our journey through life and our sexual lives and lifestyles are not just an iPod. They're not just a cigarette, you know? They're not just something like a boiled sweet that we ourselves in our little universe enjoy the way we want, and that's all it is. Yeah? Our lives are not just kind of single serve soap, you know, single-serve shampoo. But your lives are lived in a world of others, and pleasure, the worship of pleasure is lived out in a world of seeking to please others. Sexual pleasure itself is not to be found simply in personal satisfaction, personal conquest, personal fulfillment, but in pleasure being given to another. And in fact, the greatest pleasures are found there, aren't they? The greatest, I mean, a movie's never funny as when you watch it on your own, is it? We have the mega plasma magma TVs with, you know, 1,000 speakers that spin at high rates and 3D in your home, and it's all sort of shot out of a laser cannon at you. And you're all by yourself, and it's depressing. And you know, it's more enjoyable to watch, isn't it? To watch a film with others. It's more enjoyable to eat when you eat with others. I mean, it's kind of sad, those ads. Yes, I'm taking care of myself, mum ads. You know, the kind of, you're eating a frozen meal on your own. I'm reassured. Thanks. The food itself is best enjoyed wherever possible, isn't it? With others, when you can. There's something really enjoyable about cooking for others and eating with others when and as you can. Pleasure is found with others. You know, just travelling around the world and having lots of little travel relationships and friendships. That's not the depth of human relationship and pleasure, as fun and cool as it might be. Completely hammering yourself on whatever drug or booze of choice is not the best way to enjoy life, friendships, let alone alcohol. There's a great quote from, you know, a long, long time ago. I feel kind of old now when I think about the fact that Jarvis Cocker and Britpop for me was kind of still sort of current news, you know, when I was at uni. But now, I guess, in 1994, some of you were what, like four or something? And so it's not necessarily all that current anymore. So, you know, back when the people listened to Frank Sinatra and the Dire Straits and Britpop music. Anyway, one of the Britpop musicians was a guy called Jarvis Cocker, who was one of the lesser known ones, but hysterically funny. He ran on board of a Michael Jackson performance once on MTV and flashed a Mooney at the audience. It was quite funny. But he anyway, once was reflecting on drug culture and watching his friends descend into the drug culture. And he said, you know what? When you watch people taking drugs, you never hear people say, you know, ever since he's taken them drugs, he's really blossomed as a person. You know, ever since he's gotten on the needles, he's really flowered and come out of himself. Pleasure is not just best found in absorbing stimulus into yourself. Pleasure is not just found in building your own career, building your own property portfolio, building your own family. And relationships and even marriage and sexual relationships begin to suck in on themselves if they become only about themselves. Yeah? But even marriage relationships and those most beautiful family relationships exist in part to be hospitable and loving and open to others. Not simply to find the perfect person, find the perfect house, get the perfect job, and then shut down and save for super. But actually it's a life lived for others, not just for myself. And making love, sexual pleasure, it's not simply experiences, experiments, and self-expression, the three modern E's of sexual ethics. It's not simply those, experience, experimentation, and expression. It's not just getting an orgasm or giving an orgasm, but it's a relationship with another, seeking to love and serve and grow in that relationship with another as you then together love and serve in relationship those around you. Live for others, verse 3 of chapter 15. Even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me. Christ's life is the example here, a noble life, a memorable life. His life was truly a life worth living. I mean, it wasn't a pleasant life in many ways, but when you look at Christ's life, isn't that the life you would want to live, rather than perhaps the comfortable, convenient life you find yourself living? Don't you want to be living a life that means something, that's for the good of others, living for others, even when it's hard, even when I don't want to? Living alone is great. It's easy. No one messes up your stuff. No one puts the tea towel in the wrong place. No one screws up the toothpaste in the way that's meant to be done. You know? Everyone's quiet when they should be quiet and doesn't close doors too loudly. It's just perfect. They put their shoes where the shoes go. It's great living alone, but it's also quite lonely. It's horrible living in a community. A share house, those of you who live in a share house, or a family with kind of 18 siblings or something. That's hard because everyone else is an idiot. A sloppy, noisy, inconsiderate idiot. It's hard living with other people, but it's great. It stretches you. It forces you to be patient. It teaches you to deal with conflict in a loving way. It helps you do things you don't want to do for the good of other people. A wonderful thing to live with others. And so with sexual pleasure. Sexual pleasure is more than merely physical arousal. It's more than merely some kind of quest for orgasm and conquest. It's about relationship. That's why Christians are unashamed, ought to be unashamed, about the value of marriage. That marriage and sexuality is a place where sexuality can be enjoyed in an ongoing relationship of commitment and of trust and of personality, where sex and personality and relationship are all caught up together, rather than sexual pleasure just being this kind of sub-facet of your life out there with kind of fast food and, you know, Wii games and stuff. Is that last drinks, is it? Do I have to be quiet? Take the hint. Jesus lived for others, but more than that, he suffered for others. And let me finish with that. What we talk about here with Christianity is not simply living for others and finding pleasure in living for others, but last of all, being willing even to die to my own pleasure for the good of others. Look there again at verse 3. Even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the insults of those who insult you, God, the insults of those who insult God have fallen on me, Christ. The insults of those who insulted God, those who reject God, those insults got turned on Christ, and he gave himself, his life, in death to bring forgiveness. He lived the life that could have been, he could have been awesome at anything. He could have been better than that redhead American snowboarder at snowboarding if he wanted to. But instead, he lived a life in a kind of backward town, you know, and was rejected and despised and patronized, killed, betrayed for others, for the salvation of others. People say that Christianity is unhealthy, repressive, controlling. And yes, it is in a sense about denying your own desire, controlling yourself and committing yourself. But that's not always a wrong thing. In a sense, we all do that. One of the famous books of postmodernism is a series of books by Michel Foucault called The History of Sexuality. And in them, he points out the fact that that just as in the Victorian era, people were worried about their hang-ups for all these ethical reasons, so in the 20th century, people got all hung up because of their Freudian worries. We always will replace something for something else. If it's not religious prudishness, it might be scientific prudishness. Instead of going to the confession booth, I'd go to the psychiatrist's couch. No matter where we're going, we're getting worried about something. If we're not being worried about sinning against the Lord, we're worried about sinning against the inner me. We're all going to be worrying in some way or another. If we're not having self-control not to have sex with someone we're not married to, then we're trying to use lots of self-control to make ourselves want to have sex in some weird way that the boyfriend or the friendship circle makes me want to, that I don't want to, but I have to because the rules say I have to, you know? Of course we're going to be constrained. But the great thing about Christianity is that we are not just driven by guilt or worry or self-knowledge obsession, but serving others for the good of others, for the love of others. And Christ is the model, the one who lived for others, the one who died for others, who took the insults of